Take all the people from Ministry of Economy, we put them in art school, and then we put all the artists in charge of the Ministry of Economy. And then we do the foreign ministry afterwards, and we go on until we have done all of them. And then we put the Ministry of Culture in charge of all the other ministries. And then, because what is more important than culture? Culture is the identity, it's the belonging, it's who we are as humans and so on.
Says Olafur Eliasson, who we met for a new episode of Kunstpause. We are very happy to meet him in his studio, in his library, one of the most beautiful places, I must admit, that I saw in Berlin, because he would immediately like to browse the shelves and spend a lot of time here, and who we met just a few days before the Festival of Future Nows. And that's also what we are talking about in this very episode of Kunstpause.
Yes, we start with the Festival of Future Nows. It's the third episode of the festival in the end of October this year. And around 100 international artists will be presenting their works at Neue Nationalgalerie. Could you let us know a bit more of the whole idea of the festival? What can we see, and what is the intention of the festival?
I was teaching as a professor at UdK, the art academy here in Berlin, from 2009 to 14, I think it was. And of course, there was like many things going on, but one of the things was to reconsider formats or reconsider systems or reconsider the ways of doing things. Of course, mainly reconsidering what is the best way of making art, what is art in the first place, how does one actually introduce art into the world so it has an artistic, should I say, artistic consequences. And in that spirit, we also very often worked with other types of exhibitions, because as a young artist, especially coming out of a school, for instance, you are not necessarily very likely to have access to or be exposed to, you know, exhibition space, which is a white cube or which is a professional institution or Kunstverein or gallery or something like that. But that does not mean that one could not make exhibitions. So we often worked on the street, or we worked in sort of improvised spaces, or we just claimed spaces, or there's so many different ways of doing things. And there's also the whole discussion about the format of larger exhibitions, the format of biennales, museum shows, group shows. And there is the question of what type of experience does these shows typically facilitate, and have these experiences maybe been systematized, organized, maybe digested so often that there is a kind of a standardization of how to see shows, how to see biennales, how to behave, how to think, what to think. And there is, I would argue, an interesting opportunity in actually reconsidering some of that. So we landed every once in a while with this idea of gatherings or festivals or agoras or some simply sort of assemblies of people. And of course, you could also say the parliament of the street, or the sort of idea of public space and so on. So we often had some very short projects in the school, smaller projects in terms of the scale of the work, but bigger projects in terms of how many people were together. And some of these things were not by definition what would be called a work of art. They could be a dinner also. We had a dinner in the green sort of the green space between the two streets going up and down of Schönhauser Allee. We had experiments of all kinds, essentially. So this type of experimentation we thought of when the school were closing, let's make a splash with that and do a festival. Not of what we have done and not looking back, but and of course also not necessarily celebrating ourselves, but celebrating what has not happened yet. Because when you come out of an art school, it's very much about what is in front of you, and maybe less about what is behind you. So that's where the future nows actually come from. Every now that is about to happen that has not happened yet. And why don't we celebrate them? Because we might as well wish them welcome, hoping and insisting on them being better than the nows that we are currently working on. And that's actually how it started.
And if I get you right, it's really about reconsidering narrational forms also of how usually, as you said before, exhibitions are standardized in a way. I mean, obviously there's great curators around, so hopefully not, but there is some kind of standardization in how a show works. And I think the festival is indeed questioning that. It starts with a simple time where you can actually spend time till midnight and come back the next day. You get a ticket for the entire weekend. It's all about spending time in the place, which is in permanent transformation, no?
Yeah, I think that, so then, of course, there's many kinds of festivals. And it turns out people also, in the two times we've done it in the past, in 2014 and 2017, people have very different experiences. There's also quite a bit of difference in the morning, around lunch, afternoon, late afternoon, early evening, and then evening, you know, until midnight, as you said. There's a different atmosphere at midnight. Now, Nationalgalerie, of course, is a glass box, and that means the weather outside or the atmosphere outside is very visible from the inside. So that means the sun is different, the light is different, the traffic is different, the amount of people is different. And it's also there's the kind of attuning into the actual state of the day. Lowering the formality, lowering the insisting on this being like high art or red or blue chip art, or, you know, maybe being a little less insisting on this being very important and being more, shall I say, informal, suggesting that this is maybe in its casual nature also about celebrating things that are not so important or not clearly subscribing to what is considered important. Maybe this is a work, this is about doubt and uncertainty and insecurity. Maybe it's about vulnerability. Maybe this is a space where being weak is the new way of being strong. Or maybe it is this space where being slow is the new way of being fast. So this is sort of reconsidering on a more granular level in terms of subscribing to challenging the norms and the rules for what is right and wrong. Inside of that, in the whole idea of challenging something, there's of course the challenge simply the festival as a hurly-burly kind of chaos, as a circus, or as a flea market that is informal, that is unclear, there's not, is this a work or is that part over there also part of this work? What is going on here? You know, it's a sort of celebration of the time it takes for you to find out whether you are actually seeing something that is of importance to you. Normally in a museum, there's no doubt, oh, now, this is very important. I have to look, right? Everything is sort of pre-digested, you could say. And maybe there's in the idea of everything being pre-consumed for you, there's also your responsibility for actually seeing something is taken away. You are being told, this is an important painting, otherwise we wouldn't hang it here. Oh, yes, yes, that's very important. I can see it now. Maybe there is an authority there that is under... You know, it's taken for granted. Oh, please tell me what I should look at. And I think here we have something that not all of it, but maybe actually offers you the opportunity to get lost and then find yourself again.
Right. Now, you spoke a lot about the perspective actually of me as an audience attending this, this fluidity, but also for the artists that are participating, there's a huge praxis of collaboration, which is as such made possible, no?
Yeah, and this is not always easy for artists. First of all, of course, we also have to acknowledge this is a very prominent address, the Neue Nationalgalerie. And so there's a sort of paradox to be in this, you know, the peak of the German National Gallery and then having to do something that is more like for a flea market. And I think that's actually a sweet crash or clash. But the challenge is also that art shouldn't really subscribe to those kind of power structures, as art is, I think, about something else. And that is, I think, also very good for the museum. So the artists are challenged in a sense that there is a certain normative idea that, oh my God, that's such an important house. I should do something that is very that looks like real art. So that is a nice opportunity to challenge that. But there's also the great challenge for the museum to actually challenge itself and become a kind of like, well, we can actually host something which is a bit chaotic, a little bit like I think the building was intended to in the first place anyway by Mies. So I think there's a lot of opportunities in this that all in all speaks very much to the nature of how artists and art in particular works, deconstruct, it's not the right word, but to kind of reconsider what is actually power systems and how do they influence us?
And in Mayas, it's also about learning from each other. You founded the Institute für Raumexperiment in your time at University of the Arts. And in this institute, my understanding is that learning and learning methods were a big theme. So the festival is also made because we need to learn from each other, or it's a revolution about learning. I don't know. In my eyes, it sounds like museums now have to learn from younger parts of the art scene, right?
Well, learning, I don't know, it's a funny word. Mm-hmm. Museums should always be learning, one could say, or they should be synchronized with the values that the art has. I guess it's always important to remember, and that's when saying it, it might come as a surprise, if there was no artist, there would be no art, and if there was no art, there would be no museums. So let's just not forget who is important here. The museums are there because there is art, mm-hmm. right? And that means if art changes and museums want to show contemporary art, that means evidently museums has to then change as well. Clearly, it is maybe a issue if the museums prescribe what art should be and then art is made for the museums. Of course, there is a number of systems that are institutionalized into such rigorous sort of inflexibility that you end up with a number of systems such as the art market, which very much caters for special kinds of sizes or the weights and qualities of art that fits very much the art market. One could then look at that as a problem, or one could also look at it as an opportunity to kind of take money into a part of the artistic production that is otherwise unable to fertilize. So there's a few discussions in this, but at the end of the day, I of course believe that there can be nothing that is more important than art, not even the artist. I'm not afraid of saying that. So this means that if we now think of it as an opportunity, art is, I think, very much about the reconsideration of how we reconsider things. And in that spirit, there is, I think, only the one thing we have to do, and that is to actually do what the art tells us to do. And whether that is now the artist or the museum, it almost doesn't really matter, or the viewer for that matter. If you want to have a predetermined definition of what art is as a viewer, as a museum, as an artist, you are neither an artist, a museum, or a viewer for that matter. Then you're just a consumer or a communicator or a reproducer or copier or whatever it's called. The celebration really in a festival here is about nurturing what is unpredictable. You know, it's just so difficult to be unpredictable and to, let's say, to be surprising. So maybe if we lower down the, if we lower the, should I say, the gravity of the importance and everything, maybe in being a little more open for insecurity or vulnerability, we become more unpredictable, but then we also become more honest. And in that honesty, people, I think, can maybe find something they are looking for, because where do we go if we want to find honesty? Do we go to the media? Do we go to the politicians? Do we go to economy? Do we go to capitalism? Do we go where do we go to find? Or do we go to the church? Is that honest? So I'm very interested in where's the home of honesty? And I think it actually happens to be the cultural sector. I do think there is a high level of trust that this, whatever it is, let's call it art, it's actually not made to trick you or fool you or to manipulate you or to take your money. It is actually made because it has an honest agenda. It might be very abstract, it might be unclear, but interestingly, I trust it. I don't know what to use it for, but I can trust it.
It's very interesting because how you're describing it, what will happen during that weekend, which nobody can foresee, it's unpredictable and yet it's honest. And I like this juxtaposition of these two poles, so to speak, because we would most likely think of them as being opposite. But to you, listening to you now, it seems like the unpredictability of it is its honesty.
Yeah, but there is a number of things that are quite predictable because, you know, but there's a certain limit to the budget, and there's also a limit to what a typically young artist who is in the process of getting a kind of artistic statement together. A number of the participants have not had many shows. That's a kind of reality. So there are works that are in the process of developing into a big artistic agenda, and there are works that are more finished in that sense. So it is unpredictable in certain ways, but maybe the nature of being unpredictable isn't more like being open to it. It is a format of exhibition where there is a certain openness to also hold space for the things that we are not so used to dealing with.
I'd like to speak a little bit about the very logistics behind such a festival, because at the same time, wanting to create a moment that is unpredictable, that is art-oriented and thus not curator-dictated, it still needs some logistics in the background in order to work. How do you deal in the process of conceiving the festival with the teams involved, with the different studios involved, on that thin line between planning too much and not enough?
I don't think it's so interesting, actually, to think too much about it, because there is something which is very transparent about the way I think it will end up looking, and that is when people go in, they can kind of see the bolts and joints and knots, and you, when having a closer look, it will reveal itself how much work it was and how much not work it was. The institution has shown great flexibility to host us. That's really great. There's a number of, you know, practicalities at the installation level and the security level. There's fire requirements and so on and so forth. But we have kept that as a minimum. I certainly have said, if we are talking about celebrating informality, let's also be informal. This sounds like I'm not appreciating there are a lot of several people have put a lot of work into it, but I really think that the highlighting the pragmatism, logistics, and the practicalities, and all these things, that is just how life is. It is hard work to do something of some significance or some special, especially if it's supposed to hold space for several thousand people, and it takes money and time, and it's expensive. So there's a number of foundations and people who have actually supported this, and this is very important, that there is an investment in the value of culture or in art, whether predictable or unpredictable, and there is a return on that investment to the city. And that is the spirit, you know, that I think everybody working on this project is also very conscious of. This is not for nothing. This is about something bigger than just also the topic of one of the artworks. A festival, of course, is about showing that there is an alternative to art fairs. There's certainly alternative to the way art is exposed in galleries, in auctions, and the commodification of how a lot of art is actually handled. And there's also a reconsideration about how museology and display ideology and how are the rules for what is right and wrong and how what is up and down could be handled. And you know, it's great to have a, should I say, it is not that chaotic or anarchistic, but it's great to have something relatively self-organized inside of a building that is normally very organized. That, I think, highlights it a little bit more. So I think it's a great luxury to work with a team who also has done the same festival now a couple of times. And, you know, there is a certain degree of curation. There's a kind of a curatorial team. I have the names actually here because I think it's worth mentioning. Because it's, of course, Klaus Biesenbach at the museum, Lisa Botti, Christina Werner here from my studio, Ricardo Bergmann, Nicola Rickholt, and Sophia Ubach. And I myself stand behind the idea. I have enjoyed being in this team, and I'm very optimistic. As my friend Kumi Naidoo always would say, pessimism is not a luxury that we can afford.
And you are in general interested in projects that create a certain togetherness, if I may use that word. Thinking back of the weather project in London, that was such a transformative experience for me, for many people. you also mentioned.
Yes, I mentioned it in the preparing of this podcast because every winter in Berlin, I have this picture of the weather project in my phone. And I always wish to have a place here in the darkness of winter in Berlin where I can once again meet this kind of light installation and the warmness of the whole dark orange sun that was installed in Tate Gallery. So for me, it's always a thing that I'm coming up when winter starts. So, but it's only a personal thing.
But what interests you in creating these experiences of togetherness?
I mean, being together at a cultural site, or in this case, it's the Neue National Gallery, but it could also be at any other type of, should I say, it could be a Kunstverein, a Kunsthalle, a museum of various kinds, or galleries, or out on the street. The idea of sharing something, the idea of sharing an experience, I think it's first important to say that experiences are not something that happens to us. Alvar Noe, the philosopher, I think said, no, experiences are something we produce, something we create. And that means the viewer or the person who is engaging themselves is already, I should say, active, and is not just a consumer, but in a sense, a co-producer. In that spirit, when we have a shared experience, we have several people sort of producing the experiences. Of course, we influence each other, and we could easily end up in a situation where we are talking to someone and they say, oh, that red color is so warm, or that yellow color is so warm. And the other person said, well, I think it's more like kind of like, it's not really me. I don't like it. I said, wow, that's interesting. You don't like it. For me, it's like very likable, and you don't like it. That means we are very different. And we can still be together and have a conversation. I might even have an interest in continuing the kind of discussion. So culture, as I talked about a little bit before with regards to trust, has this opportunity to be a space in which it is okay to be different or to have a different view. And that means it is sort of an in-group and an out-group at the same time. See, now, when we go a little bit deeper into this with regards to collectivity and sort of community, and with regards to kind of what is it that is special about a community that holds space for, not agreeing completely. You know, I do understand that if there's a huge difference, it can be quite difficult. And let's not forget, normally when there's a huge difference, there's often very big amounts of money behind, or there is a faith involved, right? So typically it's very hard to convince people to bridge those gaps, but it should not be impossible. Now, if we have a closer look, if you are with a person who highlights that they have an emotional response that is maybe inconvenient, like, let's say, when I look at this, or when I engage in this artistic situation, I re-experience or I realize that I feel lonesome. My feeling of loneliness comes up. It could also be something else, right? So I go into this and I realize that I don't feel home here. And this could be Emeka's work that is in the collection of the National Gallery called Radio 030. Emeka Ogbo, who's a friend of mine, a great artist, and he's from Nigeria. See, now, this idea of feeling lonely, that's the feeling. Where does this feeling come from? Well, feeling lonely, what is that? Underneath the feeling, imagine it's a plant on the soil, underneath the earth, in the soil, there's the root of the feeling, right? What is the root made of? That is unmet needs. So you have an unmet need that creates the feeling. We know we cannot really change feelings with other people very easily. You have this feeling, it's very hard for me to actually change it. What can change is when you meet the person on a need-based level. So if I go in and I try to meet this on an unmet need level, then I can meet your need, or I can hear what you say. You have a request to me. What is the need that you have? And I say, aha, well, this I can help you with. The feeling I can't, but this, I can keep you company a little bit. And then you feel less lonely. See, a community or a shared space is very much for me about that. It's about acknowledging the feeling. I have this feeling, you have that feeling. You like this color, I like this color. But what is below that? It takes a little longer and it requires us to slow down. And this slowing down is something that is generally quite hard. But again, the cultural framework or institutions or wherever we meet art is it's quite good at slowing down. It slows you down. This is why we also have workshops in the exhibitions by, for instance, Joe Dumit, which is about slowness, how to slow people down. Because it's like incredibly difficult sometimes to slow down. And that is, I think, essentially about not just meeting each other in eye level or meeting each other at an emotional level, but actually meeting each other in a need-based level.
And stirring a dialogue among us, because only us, if I'm not mistaken, are able to have these kind of dialogues. Obviously, animals and plants do have other kinds of dialogues, but the way you just described it,
They have needs too.
Of course.
Yeah. And it's so interesting. That is so interesting. I do think that you can have the dialogue with a plant. And now I use the plant as a metaphor, but it's not so difficult to understand what a tree wants. It wants to tree. It is treeing its day out and day in. And what does it want? It wants water and sunlight and, some soil preferably. And what does it do? Well, it loses its leaves in the fall and it brings them back in the spring. And the leaves that it loses is used to fertilize the soil, so it has a next year it has something to eat again. So it's interesting, right? Trees are really not up for anything bad. They don't damage anything. They don't do anything bad. Unlike a certain other species that hangs around a lot, what do you call it? Self-entitled, upright, standing weeds, human, self-entitled in terms of being always thinking that we're on the top of every pyramid. So it's interesting that a tree, it is so fantastic that it doesn't do anything bad. It even has a bit of a production of air that we can breathe. I mean, without trees, we would be a mess. So now that's a side branch to our conversation here.
A beautiful one. The dialogue you're just talking about, which will happen on the spot among the audience, possibly about having different opinions, is a dialogue which you are interested in your practice. You are having a very collaborative practice, if I may say so. The studio is consisting of great minds from very different disciplines. If you look at the shelves here, you will find books from all of these different disciplines that are working in the studio, whether it be cookbooks or books about natural science or architecture. How can we improve this meeting of different disciplines in our lives? Because it's great that Studio Olafur Eliasson is able to do so and is able to organize a Festival of Future Nows where people can get a glimpse of this collaborative practice. But I feel if I look at the world right now, transdisciplinary thinking and cooperative practice or collaborative practice could indeed save not the world, but parts of it. How can we bring that out of the art sector to the broader picture, to politics, possibly?
It's a good question. Maybe all the politicians should go to art school. Why don't we take the Ministry of Economy? We take all the people from the Ministry of Economy, we put them in art school, and then we put all the artists in charge of the Ministry of Economy. And then we do the foreign ministry afterwards, and we go on until we have done all of them. And then we put the Ministry of Culture in charge of all the other ministries. And then, because what is more important than culture? Culture is the identity, it's the belonging, it's who we are as humans and so on. So that is one way, if you want to hear my view. The other way is to, I think, to take the parliament of all the politicians, simply put all of them into the art world, and not necessarily the art fair, because they probably do well there. But and then we put all the artists into the parliament. So, of course, these are thoughts that Guy Debord, for instance, had with the Citizenist. I do think that there is an overall need to kind of redevelop trust in the value of art from the side of the public. You could say the public money, for instance. I think people underestimate the return on the value return when investing in art in public spaces, art on the street, art which we all own, that art is, which is out there with the people together with schools and educations and children and in every part of society. I think the problem of silofication, which has isolated all these branches of thinking that you mentioned, often comes with what actually already starts in the school, that we divide every skill into different sort of areas without thinking about the cross-pollinization that lays in language, into history, into identity, into algebra, into spatial and architectural things, and theater and creativity and so on. I think there's one element of that. The other one is the idea of accepting that we are not always doing everything right. You know, there is a sort of privilege assigned to the, should I say, Western society that seems to suggest that we are by far much, much better than everybody else. And we talked about talking to trees before. It turns out that, you know, talking to trees is not bad in terms of understanding what is actually worth reconsidering when it comes to climate change, for instance. And of course, I know we cannot talk directly to a tree because we don't understand it. But if we actually even try to listen carefully, we could start by saying, instead of saying, that's a nice big tree. I wonder how much money I could make on that. We maybe think, what should I call it? Well, call it an oak tree. And that there's a, then quantify it, how many kilos, how tall, how much does it cost to cut it down and transport it? Why don't we say, hi, tree. What's your name? Where do you come from? What can I learn from you? Why don't we ask the tree to be the teacher in the school, for instance? Or have the tree to sit at the chairman of the board at the company, or the tree should have a seat in the parliament. The tree actually knows what it wants. It wants to be a tree, and it is treeing its way through the day, as I said before. Even thinking that, is already such a massive challenge because there's little fantasy left. There's little confidence, self-confidence left. But of course, the, for instance, First Nation people in Canada, there's many different sort of indigenous groups, and but they have a long, long history, much, much longer than we, of course, in talking with trees and plants and nature and so on and so forth. And we are now slowly, slowly, with the Western world, is considering further legislative protection of nature or the commons. We had a case in London where the air of London sued the city of London for polluting it and won. There was a salmon, there was some salmons in a river in, was it Oklahoma, I think? No. In an American state that sued a company for polluting the river where they were going up to breed eggs, and they also won. So legislative rights, that you also have experiments with economical rights and so on. So I don't think we are so far away from actually saying to the tree, what can I learn from you? Because if we actually understand what we're learning from the tree, we are less likely to cut it down and just use it for our own capitalistic consumption. So here we are in a situation where I think there is a lot happening. Of course, the Western privileged part of the world is blind or has been increased blind. And now actually there's a lot of respect, or just a little bit tiny beginning of more respect to what one could call wisdom of from indigenous knowledge, knowledge that are not really subscribing to the modern production machine of wealth and extractive thinking. These are things that are happening worldwide, everywhere. And you know, we have the farmer who is slowly acknowledging that these leaves, they actually have the same effect as these pills. But you just cannot patentize leaves. So we made them into pills and made a patent on them. So there's so much going on where there is acknowledgement of successes that are beyond, and I know I'm generalizing a little bit, but are beyond what is, I think, the kind of the modern utopia, which has led us to where? Well, to the world, which is about to collapse through its own extractive behavior of itself, like the climate crisis. And so I'm very interested in now, as you ask, how do we apply, or how do we take that onto the world? I mean, how do we change the mindsets? I don't think art always also does it, and I don't think my studio also always does it. And I'm lucky to be in my studio with a lot of talented people. I have found out this is the way that makes me feel the most, should I say, creative in the broader sense of the word. I'm not sure that I'm making a model for society. I do think that being more wholesome and inclusive and holistic in your approach to things is better. But I also think that being honest about what you believe is precision is very good. So I'm careful to using myself as an example for what is right and wrong, because I'm not sure I know, or neither do I know the answer to your question precisely. But if we look at the, you know, if at the principles, there are things we can say, and that is, for instance, how do we care for each other? What principles are we using when we talk about conflict? Is conflict about polarizing further? Is there a way to actually unify? And for sure, we here at the studio are very interested in working in ways that do not polarize and split people into groups that become more and more polarized and ends up with sort of extremist views. How do we unify without necessarily erasing the various differences that we talked about? The truth of the matter is that this festival is also not an example or model for society. It's a statement that holds, I think, potentials for various things, and we don't know exactly what. But one of the reasons why we took it up now is because I have been in Berlin now 30 years with my studio. So I have an anniversary. This anniversary, I thought with my team here at the studio to celebrate the one way or the other. And instead of celebrating ourselves, the festival seemed to be a great opportunity to actually celebrate somebody else or to give back. Because the truth is, I have received a lot. I've been very also fortunate and lucky to work with fantastic people who made right choices. I had a fantastic relationship with the gallery for 30 years now, and I had a fantastic time working with people who supported me from either Iceland or Denmark, where I come from. And there's a lot of the reasons why I could stay in Germany in the beginning was because I got, you know, public support and grants and so on. So I come from a part of the art world where I did not have to, I did have to struggle to make good art. That was one thing for sure. But I got a lot of sort of help. I had the wind in my back compared to a lot of people, and not just in the Global South and so on and so forth, but a lot of people are, you know, not being given the same opportunities. And I'm conscious of that. And in the spirit of that, I chose to come to Berlin because I thought Berlin would be the place where I could build the best infrastructure, such as the studio. I think we have 26 different languages. We have a kind of a community which is from all over the world. And we have a very interesting network of people we work with all over the world. It's truly international. And I came here because there's a freedom of speech here, and because the city here has, you know, the largest Turkish community outside of Turkey, the largest Palestinian community outside of Palestine. There's so many huge groups of, you know, different cultures. And it was a cultural melting pot. It was fascinating. I was so excited when I got here because of the German commitment to it, the freedom of speech actually was a huge thing. And of course, I also have been focusing on, this is not something one can continue taking for granted. That debate has been up and discussed widely. And that is also very interesting when it comes to, well, what does one then do? What do you actually do? And what's the right thing then to do? Because now I'm suddenly in a situation where it's not easy for me to take my huge studio with 100 people and move it somewhere else. But essentially, if I was young today, I wasn't sure I would move to Berlin to open my studio. I think this is very important to think about when we talk about what is the value of culture and what is going on and what is happening in this country. And now I've been here for so long that I even have a German passport in the meantime. I still have my Icelandic one. And now suddenly it turns out that one actually has to fight for the things that you took for granted, like such as democracy. You thought it was just completely safe. And now you have a situation where there are things that are not really as democratic as you would want them to be.
You are a Berliner, after all.
Yeah, I guess.
To quote JFK.
Do you have a favorite museum?
Do I have a favorite museum? I actually don't really. Do I? No, I don't think so. I would like to make it. I'd like to build it myself.
How would be your idea of a museum when you would make one?
That's a whole podcast in it as of itself, I think. But you know, I mean, there are great museums like there's the Manila Museum. I had a show at the Bayer. It was fantastic. And it's maybe more foundation. But there's the Louisiana Museum in Denmark. These are just pretty amazing, good-looking museums made by great architects. There's also museums who have fantastic programs. They're really great and they do great things. And therefore, they're great. Maybe they don't have the best architecture. You know, Neue Nationalgalerie is not a bad place. And they have, you know, an interesting collection. They have an interesting program. And they have a fantastic architecture. And of course, you would expect maybe Berlin, always claiming to be the moral high ground of the world, to have a slightly more adventurous museum landscape as such. But this is just typical for a Berliner to complain or to actually say about Berlin. But I think all in all, it is increasingly clear that museums should be taken into account when thinking about what constitutes a healthy and a sound self-reflexive society.
Do you have a favorite spot in Berlin or somewhere else in the world?
Oh, in my studio, but that's so boring to say. There's a new little restaurant called Hai Chidi around the corner here from my studio. I think that's my favorite spot right now.
Are you currently learning something new?
I'm studying a non-pathologizing sort of compassion-based psychology form called IFS. And I study that roughly 1 hour a day to keep myself mentally fit.
What is something you've recently failed at?
Oh, that's like all the time. I said like 5 minutes ago, I said something in this podcast, which I realized afterwards was not true, but I'm not going to reveal what that was. So I failed. No, I love my failures. The failures with regards to what we are doing here are often where the successes are.
What are you currently curious about?
Right before, we had a talk here at this very table with a person who works in something called UN Live. It's related to the UN. And they're working with an artist. The artist is called Nature. Nature is, of course, the good old friend we all know very well. I know him from Iceland. People know it from where they're from. Nature, everybody knows. So nature is, of course, often used everywhere. And now this project here is about sounds and music. So nature is the artist that is very often forgotten to be credited. It's the waves, rain, bird song, sounds of all kinds of animals and so on and so forth. So nature as an artist is very productive. It's in a huge amount of sounds and songs and so on. But we never paid a percentage or a quota or a, you never actually even credit nature. Right? So nature, this idea of turning nature into an artist, giving in the rights of an artist, and then paying money to it for what it does. It was like worth, what is it, 4.3 billion years to actually come up with that bird song. It's like, no, it's completely unfair to not credit nature for having done that. So a money back has been, I think, a trust has been made where the money that belongs to nature is put, and then nature can invest it to, you know, get better at being nature on the, you know, preventing humans to mess it up and turn it into culture the whole time, or simply just ruining it and so on. Of course, this is about the climate and so on and so forth. But what is interesting is that it's a collaboration between, for instance, music platform Spotify, and nature as an artist is going up in the charts so fast that within a year it's going to be the number one most played artist. Isn't that interesting? And you know, and money goes back to nature. And this is a non-oppositional pro-environment project. So it's very interesting that it's not, you don't have to be left or right wing or be martyring anyone just to like this project. So I'm very interested. I'm going to meet with them again very soon, as I'm very curious about the way this is organized. It's really fantastic. I, of course, was also in the starting group, and I left it. And now it's 4 years later, and I'm happy I left it because they have done so well. For sure, had I stayed on board on the project, it would not have evolved so well.
Thank you so much for thank the conversation. You so much. And thank you for listening. It's worth listening to a tree from time to time. Thank you.
Thank you.